Welcome to Work of Art, the Mason Gross podcast, produced out of Rutgers University's Mason Gross School of the Arts in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We are a community of nearly 1,200 undergrad and graduate dancers, musicians, theater artists, filmmakers, and visual artists from around the globe. My name is Laurie Granary, and I'll be sitting down with some of these artists, discussing what fuels their curiosity, their passion, and their impulse to make. Our guest today is theater faculty member Lee Savage, head of scenic design. Savage studied interior architecture at the Rhode Island School of Design and later earned an MFA in design at the Yale University School of Drama. His latest project was a Broadway production of The Lightning Thief, the Percy Jackson musical, which closed in January 2020. Savage has worked on numerous productions in theater and opera all across the country. He earned a Helen Hayes Award for a production of Much Ado About Nothing and another for a production of Twelfth Night. Lee Savage knows how to sweat the small stuff. Welcome, Lee. Thank you so much for taking the time. You know, Lee, I'm really interested in how you moved from an undergraduate architecture degree to working in the theater. Doesn't seem to be such a huge leap, but it does seem to be a pivot. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I had the luxury and good fortune of meeting a very renowned set designer who lives and works in Providence, Rhode Island, by the name of Eugene Lee. And I took a six-week course with him and sort of saw the potential of what a life in the theater could be. And he was very inspiring to me. And so although there was no theater program or course of study, he suggested that I go into interior architecture. In high school, I sort of thought I was going to major in photography or something like that. But I
You weren't building sets or anything like that in high school.
In high school, I did do a lot of fine arts, drawing, painting, photography. But I really spent time after school extracurricularly building and painting sets and being involved in the theater community there. Always backstage, run crew, stuff like that. But I sort of didn't see it as a career as much as just something I really enjoyed doing. And I think like a lot of young people are really drawn to that community that's formed backstage or on stage, which I totally felt. But I just didn't know at that point that I really wanted to make it a career.
So that time with Eugene was kind of the light bulb moment for you?
Yeah, I just, you know, he's a really charismatic figure and was so generous with his time and experience and stories that he told about the business that I just saw a life that could be made in that world. And I actually spent my whole time in Providence working with him off and on throughout the holiday breaks, the summers. And so I kind of crafted within the interior architecture program a kind of independent study track that combined the curriculum of interior architecture with this sort of minor in theatrical design. I was able to take advantage of cross-registration at Brown. So while I was there, I took theater classes at Brown and I designed three shows at Brown while I was a student at RISD. So it was a really sort of fortunate time to be there. And I was able to kind of take advantage of certain aspects of the programs to really sort of focus in a way that and make the most out of my time there.
You know, hearing you talk about Eugene, and I see how you're smiling, and I wonder, what is the significance of having someone like Eugene modeling a life in the theater, like an earned career in the theater?
Well, I think I don't know if this is true in other disciplines, but I think a lot of times in the arts, there's an apprenticeship model, and the tradition of the work and the process is passed down from one generation to the next. And that certainly can happen at school and in an academic environment, but it can also happen in the studio or in the theater itself as a school. And so, you know, I try to now, when I'm in a position to do the same, you know, I really take that seriously and recognize how not only Eugene, but my other teachers, Ming Cho Lee and Michael Jurgen at Yale, really cared about those principles as well and passing down sort of what they knew and their experiences to the next generation.
What strikes me about scenic design in the theater is that you're really creating an entire world. Mm-hmm. What appeals to you about imagining a world and building an environment?
Yeah. Well, it's a great responsibility. And, you know, something Eugene said to us early on was that architects rarely get to realize their designs. You can, you know, design an amazing building in theory, but most of the time, if you go into architecture, you're working at a firm and you're all working as a team to create something. But as a scenic designer, there's so much control over the world, and it really it can be daunting, but also really satisfying when you can put something down on paper and then build a model of it and then see it built at full scale, you know, a month later, you know? And so it's that, that satisfaction from exercising that process over and over and over that kind of keeps you going. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But the other great thing about theater is that it's not permanent. So the things that you learn from project to project, you know, carry on and stay with you. But the things that you also learn from mistakes made or failures aren't made out of concrete and bricks and steel. So they can, you know, be gone and you don't have to live with it.
I totally get that satisfaction. I can imagine there's something comforting about seeing that world, having control over that world, because outside of that, the older you get, the more you realize you have very little control over the world. So, yeah.
I mean, you also are acting as a storyteller. And I think part of that is another muscle that, you have to build and stretch and work with your team to help do, because you can create a world, but if the story that you're telling doesn't sort of fit within that world or is not cohesive in terms of what your collaborators or the story your collaborators are telling, then it doesn't matter, right? So there's another aspect to theater design where you do, or scenic design, where as a scenic designer, you have a lot of control, but at the same time, you really have to work as a team.
You have to support that story,
yeah.
Right? Well, that kind of goes into my next question, is what you see as the function. What function does scenic design play on the stage? You know, what does it do for the audience, for the actors, the playwright, the production as a whole? As you said, it's not design for itself.
Yeah, I mean, it sort of depends on so many things. I think I tend to be very excited by space. And so I start thinking about the experience of the audience as they enter the space and where the world of the play or the production starts and where the world of the audience starts. And sometimes that's very clear. And sometimes you want to blur that boundary, or sometimes it's completely immersive and there is no boundary. And so that's an idea, a theatrical idea about space that really excites me no matter what the project is. And so it's oftentimes, or sometimes, a first impression that the audience gets before the story even begins, right? And so that first impression is meaningful. And, you know, traditionally, sometimes the world is hidden behind a curtain and then it's revealed. And that sort of is one effect. And over time, that that tradition has become less so. It really depends.
What do you mean by that it's become less so?
Well, I mean, I think in a traditional proscenium theater where there's like a frame and a curtain and then your audience is on one side of the curtain and the world of the play is behind the curtain, there's that sort of grand reveal of revealing the world. And that has a certain effect on the audience. And I think that that is a very, in some ways, a very traditional, when you think about the theater, it has a sort of traditional history to it. And I think today there are more types of theaters and more venues that allow for different experiences for the audience. So when I was talking about like an immersive experience or one where the audience is surrounding the world or becoming the walls of the room or whatever, it's a very different experience, and it means something different for how the scenic design is conceived.
Yeah, the possibilities have really opened up.
Yeah.
You know, Lee, you've worked on so many productions. You've worked on opera, you know, you've worked on The Seagull, A Raisin in the Sun, you've worked on a lot of Shakespeare productions, musicals. Talk a little bit about process. How deep into the world of the play do you get? Do you read the plays you work on? Do you have long conversations with directors? I can imagine that differs from director to director. I guess, what's your touchstone to get a handle on the place you're trying to conjure up and the space you're filling?
I mean, yes to all of that. and I think reading and understanding the play and the story that you're trying to tell is essential, and agreeing to what the rules of the world are with a director are really sort of foundational for me. Why are we telling this story? Why are we telling it now? What does the time and place mean? What does the context mean for the story that we're trying to tell? And sort of establishing those big kind of ground rules that we can all kind of build upon as a team, not just the set design, but the costume design, the lighting design, the sound design, if there's projection or video, all sort of need those strong, that strong sort of foundation to build upon. So we're all kind of speaking the same language and creating a vocabulary that works together for telling the story visually or orally, or so yes. And then for me, finding kind of inspirational imagery or primary research that evokes the time and place, the society, in a broad sense, or in a emotional sense, or in a very specific detailed sense, finding like very specific details about the world.
Give me an example of what you might find.
Well, if you're trying to kind of really be very specific about a room and finding period research about what a molding profile is, you know, the size and scale of that molding, what the fabrics that were used for the upholstery, or, you know, I think with furniture specifically, you know, so much can be, so much story can be told by just the choice of a chair, because a chair is like a character and the style of that chair means so much. And again, just sort of connecting it to architecture, there's a long history of architects designing chairs because they have so much personality, and how they hold the body and the style of the legs or the height of the back, or if there's arms or not arms, or if they can be moved, you know, like there's just so many things. So what are they sitting on? What are the characters drinking? Are they drinking out of a martini glass or a wine glass or a paper cup? You know, it's those details that I think really can help tell a story about, and about the people that are living in that world, that it's really all about. You know, you can design the most amazing set, but really it's about the people living in that world and how you support the story that's being told. So sometimes design can be very, very overwhelming and slick and fancy and cool and all of those things that people go, wow, look at that. But sometimes, and I sort of live in this other camp where, you know, you just want to do enough to support the story. And sometimes design needs to take a back seat and really just be there to suggest the time and place, or provide just enough information for the story to be told and not become about itself.
Okay, so first of all, I could listen to you talk about chairs all day. I could just, the delight that you have in talking about details. But I imagine you have to have quite a bit of confidence to take the stance that you do, which is, you know what, sometimes it's not going to be wow because it shouldn't be wow. Where did you cultivate that stance? I really admire that you see your piece of the puzzle.
I mean, I think it comes from working on a lot of different types of material. And the expectation sometimes that comes along with certain productions. You know, working on a lot of Shakespeare, I think, makes you realize that, you know, Shakespeare had it all figured out, and it's all in the text, and you don't need anything, and everything you add to it is just more. And I've had really great opportunities to work on big Shakespeare with lots of scenery and creating these whole worlds, and that's been really wonderful. But at the same time, I've worked on some pieces of Shakespeare where you just need a ladder and a chair, you know, and you can do the whole show. And it's just like approaching things from both ends sometimes is really helpful. Because sometimes you don't have the resources to sort of make huge statements, but you still have a responsibility to tell the story. Right?
Well, yeah, you know, I was thinking about that. You know, you've worked I'm sure on some high-end productions where you've had the resources to make the exact world you want. You know, you have those high production values, but plenty of times I'm sure you've worked with very small budgets. What is challenging and actually fun about that? I'm sure it can be frustrating, but looking at the flip side of not mm-hmm. having the money to...
Yeah, I mean, I like to approach every show the same way and not think about the budget because I think you can, it affects how you approach your imagination and the sort of breath that you bring to the project. But very soon, you know, you're dealing with real parameters. And sometimes that's the space, right? If you're in a very small space, that means something. If you're in a big space, that means something. And I think the challenge comes in when you're dealing with a very big space and you have very little money, because you need to create some sense of the world or focus or, you know, frame for the show, framework for the show, in order just to see the people. I think the good thing about working with more limited resources, it really, a lot about design is making choices. And I think when you're working with a limited budget, you have to make sure that the choices you're making are essential to the world that you're trying to create and the story you're trying to tell. And I think sometimes if you have too much money, you're not necessarily making those same choices. And you can get kind of further away from those sort of goals.
And it's kind of like you can get flabby, right? And I would imagine a budget focuses the mind. But I love that you said that you start not thinking about the budget because you start thinking big and you don't want to limit your imagination.
Because the most exciting part of the process to me is coming up with the ideas. And I think if you come up with a strong enough idea or approach, it can be scaled to some degree. And you can stay true to that idea and maybe, you know, cut the fat out of it, you know, to still stay true to the story you're trying to tell and all of that. But maybe, you know, simplifying it in a way without throwing out the idea.
You know, being a teacher now, being in the place of being the mentor, what are you finding most challenging and most rewarding to communicate to students as you go through this process?
Well, I'm learning a lot because I just started teaching last fall. And as I get to know the students more, I feel like I can really focus on their individual strengths and weaknesses. And a lot of what we've been talking about is world building and process. But also, I've been so inspired by the ideas that they're bringing in and trying to help them realize how to translate them or transform them into a design. And that's, like I said, the most exciting part of the process for me. And so being able to do that and sort of introduce them to the world of design in a way that I feel like they may not have been experiencing up until now. The other design work that's happening out there that I'm inspired by, other designers that are working. Like when I started, I only knew Eugene, you know? And so my view of what theater design was very limited. And so I'm trying to offer the students here some of the things that I didn't have when I was in their shoes.
Where do you have them look for inspiration? Because I can imagine, just having spoken to you for a few minutes, that you find inspiration in so much.
Yeah, and I think that is an individual, that's an individual kind of response. And I think trying to see where their natural inclination lies and then offering, say, oh, well, have you seen this artist's work? Or this reminds me of a gallery show that I saw or an installation that I saw a couple years ago, and really pointing them in specific directions that can help open up their mind or sort of visual vocabulary a little bit to things that have been done that are sort of adjacent to their ideas about the play. and to see what excites them.
You start to see the importance of an education outside of the theater.
Totally. I mean, theater about theater is so boring. And I think it really is about what you bring to it. And without as much life experience, it's sometimes really hard. And so I think, you know, finding material to work on that feels relevant and inspiring to them is something I'm working on, but also opening up their frame of reference a little bit. And I know that there's a lot of conflicting opinions about internet research and Google image search, which tends to be very limited. And so I've been trying to bring in a lot of books because you sort of don't know what you'll stumble across. And there may be something that jumps out at you that is unexpected or wouldn't come up in the algorithm when you're searching so narrowly.
That actually relates to one of my questions, is how technology has changed what you do and how you approach what you do.
Well, I think it's different depending on where you're at in your experience or career. I definitely use technology every day. And, you know, the way we communicate now is so different than how it was 10 years ago, you know. Being able to send drawings around the world in 2 seconds just makes the workflow happen so much faster. At the same time, I feel like there's an expectation that the workflow happens so much faster, which I think has cut down a little bit on the exploration and discovery process that I remember being more sort of having more space for, having more time for. Everyone's trying to economize. And that means they want you to make choices very quickly.
Yeah, and you don't have time for something to simmer, right?
Right, right. And so I think the earlier you can start on a project, the better, so that there is that simmering time to sort of let ideas bake in and throw things out there. You know, I have been really talking to the students that what we do is about trial and error. And you can't expect to read a play, sit down, design it, and be done. Like, you have to make marks, and you have to make choices and see if they work, and eliminate the ones that don't work or build upon the ones that do work. And that trial and error is sort of an unknown. It takes an unknown amount of time. So things are never, in my opinion, finished. You get to a point of finishedness and, you know, you move on. So getting those, that muscle working and that process sort of under control, I think, is what I'm trying to sort of focus on right now.
As I'm listening to you, I have a lot of different words coming into my head, and I'm worried about how pejorative they are, but I'm just going to start. Talk about the benefit of failure, of error, because I don't think you think of these as pejoratives. You know, I can imagine it's really difficult to communicate that to a student, to take the work seriously, but not too seriously.
Yeah. I think you have to be at two things at once sometimes. You have to be committed to your ideas, but also, and this is a hard thing, even, you know, for experienced people to do, is to look at your work objectively after you've done it and say, okay, maybe we'd be better if we just got rid of this, you know, and be flexible about it, because it's not just about you and your work. It's, you know, you'll show your work to a director and they may be like, oh, I can't direct the show in that space. And you have to be okay with that and be like, oh, well, what if we did this? Or what if we did that? And really be reflexive and responsive. And that's sometimes hard because you spend a lot of time and energy cultivating these ideas and you get very attached to them. So that's what I mean about, but I think that's, if you can bake that into the process somehow to sort of say, okay, there's always more than one way to achieve this idea. And these are the choices I'm going to make this time and see if they work. You can kind of build that flexibility into the process.
Yeah, what is it they say? Create with heat, but then go back with a cold eye.
Yeah, or they say hold on tightly and let go lightly, which is sort of the same thing. It's like you really, you have to be committed and passionate about your ideas, but you also have to be willing to let them go if they're not right or if they don't work for whatever reason. And that may be, you know, the director just doesn't like that color. And, you know, that's okay. It can be another color. And it's not going to, like, destroy the show, you know?
Right. It goes back to service, right? Mm-hmm. What's going to serve.
Right. And I think I made that mistake very early on in my career several times where I felt like the thing that was paramount was the design and I wasn't going to compromise certain aspects of it because I felt like they were necessary, but with a little more experience, I realized, oh, that was silly. You know, it's not about me. It's not about that piece of rock hanging in the sky. It's, you know, it's the show is gonna go on without it, and it's gonna be okay.
I think that's an important perspective. You know, you alluded earlier in our conversation to the community of the theater. And even I know as an outsider, as an audience member, I've seen that. I've seen people really feel that community. Is that part of what drew you to theater? What did you love about that intensity?
Well, I grew up going to see theater in Chicago when I was in high school. And I think I was sort of deeply inspired and informed by that experience. Like, I remember going to the Steppenwolf Theater in high school, and none of the kids in my high school would ever, we lived in the suburbs, so going downtown to see theater was not common for most of my friends. But I was lucky that my parents took me, and I saw some pretty crazy stuff for a high school student, I think. And I was just blown away by it. Just the daringness and the sexiness of it and the kind of rebelliousness of it and the fearlessness of it. And I think it was a lot of that that I wasn't seeing you know, elsewhere. And it was a very different time. Like, we didn't have access to so much media. It felt very special.
What about that rebelliousness and what you were seeing on stage? Why do you think you were drawn to that? Were you rebellious? Were you
no.
anything but?
Yeah, I was trying to conform as much as possible. So for me, it sort of was like this really, you know, titillating kind of, you know, I wished I could be a part of that world. And so I took steps after I left high school to do that.
And you were lucky to have parents who were,
yeah,
who were so open.
Yeah.
What do you say to parents who are nervous to send their kids to Mason Gross, to send them into a design program? There's some real worries out there.
Totally. I can say that the skills that I've learned and the skills that I think any student of the theater learns can be applied to so many different, industries. And you learn how to communicate, whether that's with each other or communicating an idea and understanding human nature. You know, I feel like it's sort of a real renaissance form. And whether or not And I think everyone that comes here is hopeful and totally able to have a career in what they focus on, which is like the amazing thing about Mason Gross. But if those desires change over a lifetime, you can sort of tailor those skills and experience that you learn here into so many different things. And I approach my work, and I'm hopeful that I can instill this in the students, that theatrical design, that it's not just scenic design that we're learning, right? If you major in scenic design, it's that we're learning how to tell stories and be theatrical designers. And that could mean design for the theater. It can mean design for film or television. It can mean design for restaurants or theme parks or so many things. And you have to be this sort of jack of all trades. Like, you have to do a little bit of graphic design. You have to know a little bit about painting. You have to make models and build things three-dimensionally. And you have to be able to draw, or you have to learn to be able to draw, both on the computer and by hand. And, you know, so the skills that this job requires just can take you very far in whatever you end up doing.
Well, Lee, thank you so much. It's really inspiring to hear you talk about all that you love.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's rewarding to be working in a field that you love. And I think that's the other thing, is that you have to love doing it. And otherwise, it's just work. And I think I learned very early on, and my parents also realized very early on, that if you don't love what you do, what's the point of doing it, you know?
Yeah, even something as interesting as your profession can just become work if you don't love it. Mm-hmm. And you clearly have that passion.
Yeah.
And I can imagine you really translate it to your students. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you.